This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Listening to history.
To all who sleep here, we can say we caught the torch. We kept the faith. And Americans and Belgians will always stand together for freedom, for dignity, and for the triumph of the human spirit.
There is history in the air as President Obama travels in Europe this week. At one of the battlefield memorials from World War I, the president attempted to connect the efforts to stop war today with the horrors of war that began nearly a century ago.
Our nations are part of the international effort to destroy serious chemical weapons, the same kinds of weapons that were used to such devastating effect on these very fields.
Sure, it's a long way to Tipperary. It's a long way to go.
President Obama at Flanders Field, where the poppies grow between the crosses row on row, as the famous poem says, noting in tragic verse some of the 14 million soldiers who died in the Great War. Buried beneath the president's feet as he visits these killing fields from World War I is a history that lies just beyond the horizon of our audio record. Fuzzy black and white stills, scratchy voices from places like Ypres, Verdun. The world simply slid, one historian has called it sleepwalking, into that conflagration at the beginning of a new century, at a moment boiling with the distractions of radical change.
It is a sort of white water moment of history where history accelerates phenomenally. It is a time when these great inventions begin to grip millions, when industrialization, commercialization, globalization begin to be the reality of people's everyday lives.
Sound familiar? Historian Philip Blom is not speaking about 2014, but the years leading up to 1914.
Waltzing Matilda, waltzing Matilda, you go waltzing Matilda with me.
Are the echoes from World War I haunting world leaders exactly a century later, as obscure territorial disputes seem to be drawing the world into a dramatic confrontation, East versus West? Joining us to discuss all this is Margaret Macmillan, author of The War That Ended Peace, The Road to 1914. She's professor of international history at Oxford University. Professor, welcome.
Hello.
So what we saw in World War I was a sense of complacency about the world order and the map of the world as it stood in 1914. And, you know, a short 5 years later, all of that had changed. Are we in a state of complacency about the map of the world and the world order right now and don't see the potential for radical change?
I think there's something in that, because I think we get used to peace and we like to think it's a normal state of affairs. And I think in Europe before 1914, they'd had an extraordinarily long period of peace, punctuated, of course, with short wars. And I think they got used to the sense that peace was normal, that they could get through the crises. And perhaps we have something of the same since the end of the Cold War. And goodness knows there have been conflicts, but they haven't spilled over yet into much larger ones.
As a historian, can you describe the dynamic between the kind of big picture that leaders like President Obama speak about, how to behave in the 21st century, lecturing Vladimir Putin, the notion of territorial sovereignty in Ukraine, that sort of thing, and the passion of these very localized disputes of Russian-speaking majorities in Crimea, just as in the Balkans there were Serbians and Bosnians who were angry at each other, and that escaped the gaze of world leaders in 1914.
I think we always have a tension, if you like, between the sort of larger forces pushing for stability and the sorts of forces that can disrupt that stability. And I think we recognize, perhaps more clearly than we might have done in the 1990s, just how much people can be moved by passion, whether it's national passion, nationalism, or whether it's religiously inspired fervor. I mean, we're not always rational human beings, and we sort of take very seriously the ways in which we identify ourselves. And so you do get, I think, at a lot of levels, you get people feeling very strongly attached to particular identities. And I sometimes wonder if it's almost a result of globalization or tied to globalization somehow, that the more the world gets integrated, and perhaps the more strongly people cling to these very strongly felt national identities or local identities.
the Great War, as it was then called, and World War I it became, of course, after World War II, is such a historical gulf. It's almost impossible for us to imagine our way back to what it was like in 1914 in the months leading up to the Great War. Can you help us do that? What was it like, and are there echoes today that you see? You've written about some in thinking about the conflict in Europe and some of the conflicts in the Middle East.
I don't think a lot of people were thinking that a war was coming, even in early 1914. I mean, they'd got used to the fact that there'd been crises before, but everyone had somehow muddled through them. And I think we should never underestimate just the sheer role of accident. I don't think that war in 1914 had to happen. It hadn't happened in previous years, even though there'd been talk of war. And I think what you got at the very end, in the last month of the crisis, before Europe went to war in a general war at the beginning of August 1914, was a series of very human mistakes, miscalculations, failures to understand what the other side might do. I think they could have avoided the accident. I don't think it had to happen. And I think we have to hope today that we will have leaders who are wise enough, who are sensible enough not to move precipitously, who are prepared to try and understand the other side, prepared always to talk to the other side. So I think we shouldn't be too pessimistic. I think we have a lot of goodwill in the world, a lot of sense that people want peace to continue. But I think we should really be careful, because I think we should recognize that accidents do happen, and I think we really have to be careful to try and avert those.
How would you evaluate the rhetoric of President Obama? He's certainly a great speaker and can evoke a mood. But does he sound to you like someone who is complacent, or does he sound more to you like a Churchill who's absolutely convinced he knows what's about to happen?
I think he sounds to me more like some of those Democratic leaders, including Neville Chamberlain in the years before the Second World War, who were very concerned. I mean, I think Chamberlain's been unfairly attacked as an appeaser, who were very concerned about the rise of Hitler and the aggressive policies of countries such as Germany, Japan, or Italy, but who were trying to build a coalition to deal with it. And it's always a problem for democracies, because we have to get consensus and we have to work together. And it seems to me Obama is trying, I think quite rightly, to bring different countries in the West together to act in a unified way. But it's not easy, because until there's a very clear and pressing threat, we tend to always think of our own national interests. And what Obama is doing, I think quite rightly, is signaling that there really is a concern about the way in which Russia is behaving, but is trying to keep the door open to more negotiations and trying, I hope, to show the Russians that, you know, they really have to be careful not to go too far. I mean, a lot of it depends now on what Putin does.
And where does Putin sit in thinking back to 1914? Does he remind you of a character who was a change agent then, or is he something fundamentally different?
I think he is a character who's a change agent. I can't think of an exact analogy in 1914. He's a passionate nationalist. I mean, he's someone who's been deeply humiliated, like many Russians have been, about what happened to the Soviet Union after the beginning of the 1990s, the way it fell to pieces, the way Russia was left as a much smaller country with huge economic problems, with much diminished influence internationally. And I think he's thinking perhaps a sort of parallel, but then they're not the same sorts of characters, is with Kaiser Wilhelm II of Germany before 1914, who also felt very strongly that Germany was not getting its place in the sun, was not getting the recognition internationally that it should. And I think this is something that moves Putin. I mean, you saw it in his speech last week. You know, we've had enough of being pushed around. We've had enough of being told what to do. And I think this is something we all have to understand in the West. This is a very deeply motivated man who wants to restore what he sees as Russian grandeur and greatness.
And if we think about the world back then, it was a smaller place. The flashpoint, of course, was Sarajevo and the Balkans. But there are numerous potential flashpoints, and you've written about them here. And we're not simply talking about Crimea. You could also speak of Iran. You could speak of Damascus. You could speak of Moldova. You could speak of Chechnya if you wanted to. How many more flashpoints do you think there are today than there were in 1914?
Well, I think there were quite a few in 1914 as well, because there'd been quite a lot of colonial rivalry. For example, the British and the French nearly came to war in 1898 over a bit of the Sudan. And so I think flashpoints are always there. It's what you make of them. And in a very globalized world, of course, powers have international interests and are more likely to get into flashpoints much further away from home. I think another potentially very dangerous area for us in the present time is the seas, are the seas between China and Japan, where you have a number of national interests, a number of claims being made. And I think what's very dangerous is when you get nations talking of things like prestige and honor. These are intangible things, but they're things that nations often feel very deeply. And of course, again, what is similar, I think, today to the past is the way in which public opinion is playing a role.
And there, of course, is the pivot to Asia that the president really wanted to be the feature of his foreign policy. Maybe that's the blinder in this 2014 analogy to 1914, that, in fact, we're not really thinking of Asia. We're thinking much more of what's going on in Europe. And that could be the outlier, the surprise 100 years later.
Well, we don't hear so much about the pivot to Asia now, do we? I mean, I think that was very much the theme of the first term of President Obama's presidency. But clearly, the United States still has massive Asian interests. But I think it was always a mistake on the part, perhaps, of the president to ignore Europe quite so much. It's still enormously important for the United States in terms of alliances, in terms of commonality of interests, and also, of course, in terms of trade and security. And I think a mistake that a lot of people made, and I suppose that we can't always worry about everything at once, but I think we did collectively, and I would say this goes for administrations as well as for members of the public like me, we tended to assume that Russia would just be content to chug along as it was, sort of on the edge of Europe, not really all that important. And I think that was a mistake. I think we failed to recognize the depth of the sense of humiliation in Russia. And it may be too late to do much about it now. I mean, I think what is important now is to have a strong and robust response to what is going on in Russia, and to make it clear to Putin that if he tries to move into eastern Ukraine, that Russia will suffer consequences, economic consequences, for example.
Margaret McMillan is the author of The War That Ended Peace, The Road to 1914. She's professor of international history at Oxford University. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
Let's leave you now for the moment with this moment from President Obama today speaking at the Flanders Field, quoting the famous poem known by virtually every schoolboy and schoolgirl of the 20th century in Europe, In Flanders Field, by Colonel John McCrae, who died in 1918.
To you, from failing hands we throw the torch. Be yours to hold it high. If ye break faith with us who die, we shall not sleep, though poppies grow in Flanders fields. What is lesser known is that 3 years after he wrote those words, and thousands of miles away, an American schoolteacher named Moina Michael read McCrae's poem, and she was so moved that she wrote a response. Oh, you who sleep in Flanders fields, sleep sweet to rise anew. We caught the torch you threw, and holding high, we keep the faith with all who died.
And the band played Waltzing Matilda as the ship pulled away from the quay. And amid all the tears, flag waving and cheers, we sailed off for Gallipoli. Well, I remember the terror.